Aye.
No, Mike.
Oh, fuck it.
He will be the way.
I just want to get the technical part working again.
Can people see the screen well enough from back there?
I'll just talk to the screen. I'm used to that anyway. I want to say thanks very much. It's really, I didn't realize how much of a history buff I was until I started digging through the files when I worked at Pan Canadian, actually. And over time, we just sort of started collecting pictures and slides, and from that we started building the stories. And from there, I don't know if many of you know Bonnie Meck. Bonnie joined in Canada, Pan Canadian, 25 years ago, and she also recently retired. So the two of us were sitting around saying we should start capturing this while we're still there and while there's some employees there. And actually, the last couple of years, the company said, yes, we need to do something about capturing the history before it leaves. And that's part of how this was all developed. The nice title I had, I can't believe it. I dreamt that up myself, and I read somewhere it says, you know, when you're getting close to retirement, you get a great big long name, title, and then corner office. And I said, I must be getting close to retirement then. That's where I'm at today. So what we're going to learn today is how in Canada obtained its fee title, which was really freehold mineral rights. And then what's the significance of this to the Petroleum Historical Society? All of our land in Canada, you know, Western Canada is based on the Torrens land system. It's really maintained by the Crown, and they guarantee title as long as it's registered at land titles. And that's really the beginning of how in Canada owns this land today. We always call it fee simple. So if you own a house, you own fee simple title in the surface rights. Today we're talking about the mineral rights underlying that. And really, fee title ownership is absolute. However, it's limited by still some government powers, so they didn't give you absolute control. The government always has eminent domain, which means it has the right to expropriate land, and they do it fairly regularly on surface if their municipalities are expanding. They don't do it often on mineral rights. They have the right to tax the land and the right of escheat, meaning if there's no longer a freehold owner or a descendant and they can't find any heirs, that land reverts to the Crown. It's a very long process for that to happen. And police power. They have the rights to go on the land, and that usually pertains to the surface because they're not about to go underground and occupy the surface mineral rights. So this is a slide I got when I started with the company in 1970. So I can't remember the fellow's name, but somebody from Mobil Oil, he was the JI rep, and maybe Dick Danick remembers who he was. But he drew this out for a seminar, and I've gone to a lot of places since, and that's kind of a historical document, and it's still in circulation today. I see it all the time. So that's kind of a historical slide. It really says the surface rights are the lands on top, and it covers a bit of sand and gravel and marl, but also that may be contained in the mineral rights as well. So it's not a clear-cut picture really where surface starts. A lot of people believe it's the top 18 inches, but it's really an ownership. And we're talking about the ownership from the center of the earth to the... So really we're talking about from the center of the earth up until the surface rights take place. So I said we're going to start at 1676. But I was at a presentation last week, a lady on First Nations presenting, and really our history of land didn't start in 1676. It started about 4,000 years ago. And so she shared this slide with me. This was the map at first contact when the Europeans arrived. And so from the First Nations said this is the way it looked to them when the European settlers got here prior to 1676. Well, to talk about Rupert's Land, this is this one version of Rupert's Land. So really in 1676, all the lands that flowed into the Hudson Bay were granted to the Hudson Bay Company, and Prince Rupert was the head custodian, I guess you're going to say, the owner of Rupert's Land. So all those lands belonged to the British government, and over time that map expanded all the way to the Pacific Ocean and to the Arctic. That's just one version of it. So when Canada was formed in 1676, it took till 1870, and eventually the Hudson Bay trade monopoly was abolished, and they opened up the lands to any entrepreneur. And the Hudson Bay Company ceded all of Rupert's Land to the Dominion of Canada, but they reserved sections 8 and parts of 26 in every township divisible by 5, and those became the HB lands. So the Northwest Territories was created, and this is an old map that says this is what the Northwest Territories looked like in 1870. So we had Manitoba, Keewatin, Saskatchewan, Assiniboia, and Alberta were the territories. so they weren't provinces at that time, and that's the area that was opened up for settlement. And this is a historic map, and this is really the CPR main line here. Okay. So in 1870, really we had the provinces. Canada was, this would be Eastern Canada, this was Manitoba at the time, and of course British Columbia was off to the west. So why was the railway built? Well, Canada wanted to bring British Columbia into the Commonwealth of Canada, and in order to do that they committed to build a railway tying Eastern Canada to British Columbia. And they actually started in 1871. The idea would be finished in 1881. However, after 10 years, I think they were just getting close to Winnipeg. So they formed a new contract with Canadian Pacific Railway to complete it by 1891. And that's part of the land grant where state and Canada owns the mineral rights. It all started from this 1881 land grant. So what is that land grant? So CPR was granted $25 million cash to get the railway started and 25 million acres of land that they could sell to settlers to keep the cash rolling in, to keep building the railway across the country. They also had a clause in there, people call it the crappy lands clause, that said if land wasn't fit for settlement, they could exchange certain lands for other lands. And this becomes very important as we move through. They have this right to select other lands. So the lands that they were given was on a belt of land 24 miles wide on each side of the CPR right-of-way in a checkerboard pattern. And this is the pattern we often see today in land. You see why are certain sections in Canada lands or freehold lands and certain land crown. This is a typical section, so it's at 8 and 26 were kept for Hudson Bay, 11 and 9 were kept for school grounds, and if the CPR could select along the railway, the shaded areas, and the white areas were open crown lands, so the crown had the rights to those lands, and CPR had every other section or town. Okay. So this is an old picture I found of an old land office, and I have to assure you these are not skulls down here from settlers who had passed on. They're really, it's an old land office, and people went in to do transactions with CPR. And I'm not sure this is a CPR land office, but it's a historical slide that's floating around. We don't know what it is actually. I don't know if you can see this, but this is the color. There's quite a bit of green in here, and this is what the lands that CPR could initially select. So that's the band we talked about, and they had all this land here, and it started at Winnipeg and moved across the province. So that's kind of what the original grant. Yeah, I think this is the 25 million acres, the original. They said, here's land you could select, and it's a checkerboard. And from there, they started working from that and then selected other lands. And they acquired other railways along the way, and they built additional railways. But that's the region of the original CPR map. That's at the Glenbow Museum, by the way. So what they did is started advertising. So really, they have, a lot of people see these. They say, come out to Western Canada, that's the land of milk and honey. You get 160 acres free. The Crown gave the lands free as long as they homesteaded it. CPR sold the lands for $1 an acre, so if it was Crown land, you got it for free as long as you homesteaded it and built a building on it. CPR actually sold it because they wanted the cash. And of course, it's the old picture here. It says, we're sailing west to prairie land, sun-kissed and blessed, the Crofters Trail to Happiness. And so we know that's still going on today because everybody still thinks this is the road to happiness coming to Western Canada. So what happened 150 years ago is probably still today. So that's Western Canada. In order to figure out what they were selling, the survey system, the DLS survey system was incorporated, and really everybody says, why does West of the First start halfway through Winnipeg, Manitoba? And that's really, they started surveying at Winnipeg and went across to the West. And they broke everything down in townships, ranges, meridians, townships, and sections. And everybody talks to, they always talk west of the fifth, west of the fourth. You hear those words used a lot. And I always tell people west of the fifth, if you're going down Barlow Trail in the northeast, there's a little road that runs along Barlow Trail, and that's Meridian Road. So people say, well, that's west of the fifth. Then you head up toward Edmonton, you know, on one side of the highway, it's pretty close to the west of the fifth. And geologically, I think everybody will say things change a little bit, not only the weather. So this is an old survey plat that I dug out of CPR files, and it just says, here's where we are today at the Stampede Grounds, and that's what it looked like in 1884. I also found the same map in the National Archives, so this seems to be a very popular one that floats around for historical purposes. You know, I don't know. I'd have to go back to the original and find the source. in 1884?
Could be Sand Hills.
Could be Sand Hills. It's whatever the surveyor wrote in there. That might have even been an early cemetery. I'm not sure if that's where Cemetery Hill is. I'm not sure if it was there in 1884. So CPR, as they built the railway from 1888 to 1902, and they sold the lands to the settlers, they reserved no mineral rights. They sold the mineral, the surface, absolutely everything. And as you know, as the train started coming, they realized, oh, maybe we should start retaining something, like coal, possibly petroleum for bunker fuel. So between 1902 and 1911, CPR reserved coal, petroleum, and valuable stones. And at that time, petroleum included natural gas. So really, when they said petroleum, they thought they reserved everything. Then after 1912, CPR reserved all rights. So when they sold the land, they kept all their fee title ownership. So in 1883, a lot of you know that CPR was trying to drill a water well for their steam engines, and they struck gas at Langevin Siding down around Medicine Hat. And there's a roadside cairn, I guess it's a historical site that is down there. I've never been there, but I know I've seen the write-ups even in the Petroleum Historical Society. So this, a lot of this information is still in the Encana archives. This is an old CPR, I call it the LAN system. So this is how we kept track of land records. Really, they had these are linen sheets, and they wrote the township and range. And somebody must have had a little stamp. They stamped what was retained. And as they did deals, they wrote them in pencil so that if a lease expired, they erased it and wrote the new lease on it. So that's how we kept track of things. They had a lot of ledgers that came over with all when the lands are granted, and it's a duplicate of what was that land titles. And I believe they're still at land titles, but I've heard some discussions that maybe a lot of the files were destroyed.
I think I can help you out there. When I was investigating my great-grandparents who came out in 89, they bought CPR land.
Okay.
And these clerks sat in Winnipeg at these long desks on the high chair, and they had no rhyme or reason. They were just put in as they came in. And when I was looking for it, I ended up at the Glenbow, and they had just been given to the Glenbow by Marathon Realty.
Right.
And who was the curator then? Dempsey. Said, I think you will find your great-grandparents' plot in this book. And there was, I don't know how many, they'd been there maybe a month and a half. He looked through every book.
Okay.
And he has obviously has a photographic memory. And I found it on page 109 of this book. And he paid $3 an acre to the CPR 89.
Okay, I'll mention that when I get to that slide. Why there was a difference. And this is an old, this is how we kept track of our records. They were just done on little sheets. They kept them in a little book. And we still have these active. We still use, or can still use these today because it's historical. They've never been updated to a computer system. And when you get back in those old files, there's more information on these old sheets than there are in the new computerized generated one. And everything in these days was signed and approved by J.M. Taylor, who was the manager of Canadian Pacific Oil and Gas at the time. So that's how seriously CPR viewed their land records, that they were signed by the manager. Not that other companies don't do it today, but the volume is incredibly different. So we talked about 1903 is when CPR said, well, we've got a lot of land between Calgary and Medicine Hat that's unfit for settlement. And they, I can't remember exactly who it was, they got this idea to build irrigation projects and make the land more fit for settlement. So they started the Western Irrigation District at Chestermere Lake and started the Eastern at Bassano Dam. The idea was to make the land more fit for settlement, and in doing so, they would increase the price they charged. They would make more money. So I think it went up to $11 an acre during this period. But actually, they said it wasn't very successful. So at the end of the day, what they had for that, they got to select large blocks of land outside of the railway. Okay, so it's not that checkerboard pattern. So from doing the Chestermere and to the Eastern Irrigation Districts, they got to select a block of land running along the Bow River to the south, the Red River to the north, and they selected this block of land. And that's the one people would call it the Palliser Block. So when you see that, that came as a result of the irrigation projects. And there was a lot of value added to making that land fit for settlement at the time. That's probably long forgotten. Everybody says, well, why do they own all this land? Well, it was really building the irrigation districts at the time. Something similar around Lethbridge, so the Raymond, Milk River, and Tabor Irrigation Districts. and they CPR acquired the Alberta Railway and Irrigation Company, and really ended up with this called the Lethbridge Block. But large parts of it, it didn't cover the coal rights, which is owned by Galt Mining, and I think the Galt Museum, probably down there, they have a lot of historical records around this block and around the coal rights that were left there. So in 1912, when CPR started retaining all rights, they formed the Department of Natural Resources, and I believe they built the Department of Natural Resources building, which is right where the Palliser Square is today. There were no records, and my wife actually worked at Pan-Canadian, that's where I met her. She actually drew this picture for Pan-Canadian at the time, because they wanted to keep some historical document of the building. And we talk about the CPR vault. Well, they had vaults because they had to keep all that money somewhere. And everybody called it the vault, and it was secure. And today, a lot of people see land contracts that says vault copy. But CPR kept all the records in a vault. They locked it up, and so it was considered almost the same as cash. Royalties, they started collecting royalties, and on the 25th of the month, everybody brought their bags of cash to this building and dropped it off at the cashier. The next day, the Calgary police came and escorted the cashier to the bank. And I think, and CP thinks too, that all of our industry today, we say everything is due on the 25th of the month. That's usually when money exchanges hands in the oil and gas industry. And we think it started because of this cashier was open for business on the 25th. So we don't know that, but that's just what an assumption we're thinking. That's where that 25th came into the Canadian leasing and the Canadian business. And part of that, I said they kept all the records and titles and leases, and that was all transferred to Encana Archives. And a lot of it still was transferred to Montreal. It's in CPR Archives, and they call it the Montreal Vault. So that's the terminology. That's what they're thinking. It's land is like cash. We want to make sure we manage it the same as cash. The Edmonton Block was another selection of land between, at least from Drumheller up. And that was the acquisition. It's all checkerboard. A lot of it was through acquired railways. There's the Calgary-Edmonton Railway, the Lacombe-Stettler Railway, and CPR later, when they merged, the Calgary-Edmonton, it was only the land they had left. A lot of people said, I thought Mobil had those, or Devon, or somebody else, but it was the lands that were left in that company when they acquired them that went. And that causes generally a lot of confusion in oil and gas, because which lands did they acquire? In 1967, the famous Husky Block, so CPR and Husky negotiated a deal with Husky. Husky would build a heavy oil refinery to provide bunker fuel to the railway. Husky picked a location between the CN Railway and CP Railway, so they would have two purchases of their bunker fuel. And CPR did a deal with Husky that says, we want to make sure you have the lands to keep on drilling around Lloydminster. And so somebody must know who these two gentlemen are, if anybody would like
to. One.
Yeah?
Yeah.
This fellow here?
I don't know who that is.
John Taylor.
I think it's
Taylor. Yes, John Taylor, he was the manager of CPOG and Glenn Nelson from Husky, signing the historic Husky agreement.
It is.
And that gave Husky...
required to drill a bunch of wells and shoot a bunch of
sites. Right. There's lots of obligations that came with, and it's one of those historic agreements that's still going today, and it's still a historical document, an active agreement. So in 1930, the federal government transferred all rights to the provinces, and when they did that, the old deal with CPR was they would never tax the CPR lands. But as soon as it became the provinces, they had the right to amend that. So one by one, the provinces all brought in taxation acts. And in Alberta, CPR surrendered about 700,000 acres of coal rights, and in Saskatchewan, about 700,000 acres of coal and a bit of PNG. In 65, in Alberta, they passed the active legislature saying all the lands owned by Calgary and Edmonton Railway and Canadian Pacific Oil and Gas were transferred to Canadian Pacific Oil and Gas Limited. So it's actually an act in Alberta that transferred all the lands. In 1973, the Stabilization Act came in. The Saskatchewan government basically expropriated all the producing rights. So that was their power that says if it's in the public interest, we will expropriate. So this 1973, all the producing rights were transferred to the provincial government under the Stabilization Act. The deep rights the companies kept. And BC took, also in 1973, put theirs in, and Canada, or Pan-Canadian at the time, surrendered 3 million acres to the BC government. They kept about 7,000 acres left. And that's just it. There's lots of legislative acts that happen, and these change over time, and we never know where it's going to go. A couple of historic cases, the Turda and Boris. This is an old fee title. So every transaction at land titles was the stamp on the document. You had to filter through all the handwriting to figure out what was owned and what wasn't. So 1949, where the Leduc discovery happened, Boris owned a quarter section of land. He had a title that said all coal, all rights, all mines and minerals, excluding coal and petroleum. And the challenge was, who owns the natural gas? Because up until this time, natural gas was included in the petroleum. And this case went all the way to the Privy Council in England, and they came back and said, the person that owns, not the petroleum, but everything else, owns the natural gas, but not gas in solution. So what happened in Alberta, we have a split. So if it's the gas cap, it's owned by the owners of natural gas. Any oil in solution, gas in solution, is owned by the petroleum owner. And that's created a split title issue that just keeps going on and on. Also at the same time, they established rule of capture. The owner of the mineral rights has the right to go on the land and capture their production. They also had to change the Surface Rights Act because of that. It says, well, you may have the right to, but you need consent of the surface owner. And they changed the Surface Act to give more rights around the surface owner around consent. And again, that's still going on today around access to surface land. They changed the Land Titles Act around the splitting the titles, so we created a surface right title and a mineral title. And a lot of the Conservation Act was changed at the same time around spacing units and holdings to make sure the gas owner didn't produce all the gas and destroy the petroleum rights.
When you are producing the gas, how do you know if the gas is from the gas cap or is it gas in solution?
That's a technical question. Actually, the EUB monitors that pretty closely, along with the engineers. They have to monitor that. And there's been some court cases around companies that didn't monitor it. And so you might start paying the owner of the petroleum, and then eventually it becomes gas, and they continue to pay the petroleum owner, and then you could get into a court decision, but there's lots of precedent set around determining who owns, what kind of gas it is. So there's been several challenges to this case after this, around how do you know who actually owned it. And each time they've come back and said, well, the petroleum owner owns solution gas, but there's a gas oil ratio, and there's a technical answer to that question. But if you find that scenario, check with your production engineer. Turda was the next adjoining case, and he also had a split title. And he had a title that said he owns all mines and minerals, excluding coal and petroleum. CP had a title that said they owned all mines and mineral rights, because remember I said they transferred at one time all coal, petroleum, and valuable stone. And the land titles register, of course, was putting all those stamps on there and missed the stamp where it was transferred. And years later, he found the mistake and corrected it. In between there, the land was transferred to Turda. And so Turda said, well, I own it. And CP said, we own it. They had actually leased it to Imperial, and they went to court. They went to the Supreme Court, and they came back and said, a mistake had been made, and Turda was the owner of the land, and the compensation had to be paid to the owner of the mineral rights. So that was the Land Titles Act change that came as well. It said if a mistake is made, they compensate the owner of the lost rights. So I think CPR received $160,000, and it was valued at $1 million in 1952. The other thing is the Mineral Resources Act that came in 1989. People back then were going around picking up ammonite. They'd find it laying on the surface, and they were making jewelry. That's how that transition works. And they approached Pan-Canadian for a lease, and they gave, I guess, the one company that has most of it, and they said, we own it. Of course, everybody said, well, you can't just go on picking up. That looks like it's a gemstone. So I went to court, and the courts ruled that it was a mineral, and Pan-Canadian, the mineral owner, did own it. So that was in the morning, and then in the afternoon, the Historical Resources Act said, well, they've classified it as a mineral subject to the Act, so in the afternoon, it belonged to the province of Alberta. So in other words, we own it. Because it's not your normal mineral, it's kind of the in-between, but it is a fossil. You can't say it's not a fossil, so I think it was right to say it's a fossil and protected by the province. How it works to get the jewelry, I'm not quite sure, but I think they lease it now from the provincial government. So I'm just going to go through the next slide. So really, CPOG was formed in 1958, so we dug up some old things. 1969, CPOG acquired Centerdale Real Oils, and I know Bob Redman is here, and he was talking about how that happened. And really, they acquired a large part for the Weyburn Unit, and today, you're talking about in Canada, Weyburn Unit is still one of their major areas, and the unit has a lot of value. not only to us, but also for the environment. So in 1971, Pan-Canadian Chains created, merged with Canadian Pacific Oil and Gas and Central Del Real Oils, and Pan-Canadian Petroleum Limited was formed. They've had a couple of different logos. I talk about AEC was created by the Alberta government in 1975 through a sale to the public. The shares were $10 each. 80% of those who subscribed were individuals, so it really was an Alberta company at the time. In 1993, Alberta government sold the remaining 50% shares, and AEC became a public company. 2001, CP split into its various fractions, and Pan-Canadian Energy was formed, which was their oil and gas arm. And then, only a few months later, AEC and Pan-Canadian merged and became Encana Corporation. So I've got a couple more slides, I think. How are we doing for time?
Good.
Okay. So this is what Encana's fee title land looks like. If anybody's on a map, the land, this group of land people back here, you see all this land, and this really represents starting in Winnipeg. They really weren't too interested in keeping lands. They kept it around the railways. You can see the main line going through here. As they started getting in Alberta, you say, well, here's where they decided to really start keeping their mineral rights. And it was very fortunate that they kept it in Alberta, where all the oil and gas was. Although they were only looking at surface rights, they said, is it fit for settlement? And that's the logic behind selecting lands. But sometimes people say, why are there no lands in here? And if you drive down the highway, you go, oh, that's why there's nobody living here either. It's not fit for settlement. And same with down here, you get into that far southeast dry country. And there's lots of oil and gas there, activity, but there's no settlement. And that's kind of the philosophy that went in. It was just a matter of timing. By the time they got to Alberta, things changed and the discoveries happened in Alberta. And historically, we always say CP has about 10.8 million acres of land, and that's what we tell everybody, but we know it. There's so many different rights now, it depends how you're counting it, that no one really knows. The Alberta government still has a number, and they say they don't know what it is anymore either, because it depends how you count it. But historically, we say 10.8 million.
What's the real checkerboard area? Just east of the, yeah, right
down here?
Just about there. Yeah.
That's
the perfect checkerboard.
Oh, right here?
Yeah.
That's Suffield. How that came about, I just mentioned, I didn't talk about that, but as CPR, Pan-Canadian AEC, they actually acquired Hudson Bay lands along the way. And even in this block, see, there's no blanks, because CPR acquired the Hudson Bay lands. And down here in the old map, there was some checkerboard, but this shows you where they acquired the Hudson Bay lands in the Suffield block. So when you see those patterns, if you work in land, you start to recognize those patterns. You go, oh, that's Hudson Bay land, because it's 8 and 26. This is an old chart. Again, I got that in 1971 when I started. But again, it starts, origin of lands, it starts in 1676. But this really shows how things went through the Hudson Bay, came down. You got Hudson Bay lands, origin, CPR lands, settler lands, and then Crown and Indian lands. So from all that, everybody says in Alberta, government, if you go to their website, they say they own 81% of the lands in Alberta. So it depends how you count, that's the historical number. 9% is owned by the federal government, national parks, Indian reserves, and Veteran Affairs. 9.5% is freehold, held by corporations such as Encana, Devon, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, Apache Galvin, go on. And just somewhere between 1 and a bit higher is freehold. So we talk about all the individuals out there that own mineral rights. In comparison to the overall picture, it's very low. But voice in government, I think these people have more say than possibly anyone else. And we talked about mineral tax. Even though they did the royalty review and said we're changing the royalty structure, they also decided they were making no changes to the mineral tax. Because the mineral owners down here pay 4 to 7% mineral tax, not the higher number for royalties. They do lease it out and they share that with, but it is quite a different number when you get down in here. However, it says freehold, the government can't, they have to be equal and fair, which means freehold lands held here also between 4 and 7%. Subject to the same rules as freeholders. So I think that's more of a political thing. I'm not going to go there. But in Canada, archives in Canada has a lot of historical records, and you mentioned the files pan-Canadian at the 100th anniversary of CPR through Marathon and that whole chain. They transferred almost all the surface rights to the Glenville and said, here's our surface files. Last year, we also found another 100 boxes of surface files. They were all transferred to the Glenville. But all the mineral records are still at Encana. And I think there's an opportunity there because they're building the new Bow building, and I think there's an opportunity for the Glenville or the Paternal Historical Society to say, well, yeah, you've had these files for a long time. Is there an opportunity for something to happen? And really, there's a huge cost to storing archival records in a company. History. I couldn't mention I did a book. I did this. I started writing the history, and we did a brochure really capturing a lot of what's in that slide presentation today. And fortunately, in Canada, we had consent to do it internal. So because it's internal quality, we can't send it externally. But I will approach them and see if they'll make copies available to the society. But they have standard around what's external and internal, and this is just an internal standard. But I like, for historical document, I like the poorer quality paper because it has that look and feel of a historic document. So I try to get approval for today as well, but it's not high on their list. But I said I will continue, and I know they are reviewing their stories of their archives and their historical files. And believe it or not, you mentioned Manitoba. Through part of this project, we're going back and they're transferring all the files from CPR into Encana's name. And they found in Manitoba a lot of it's still in deed. And so they've got a huge cleanup left in Manitoba trying to get it out of deed into title so they can transfer it to Encana. So there's still all that historical work. And you're right, when I went for a visit down there, they're still standing at the counter and they're still pulling the books out, just like you said, they did 100 years ago. And they say they're still working in 100-year-old technology. Everything's manual. And they're trying to bring their system up to standard as well. So we actually have somebody working in their office. And he has no chair. He just stands at the desk. So, and he worked there for 40 years, actually. So he's used to standing and working at the counter.
What's the difference between
deed
and title?
Deed is pre. There's no guarantee of title under deed.
Yeah,
it's just what somebody... Oh, a deed is really... It's just how things were done before we came to the land title system. So a deed is basically the old records, even prior to that, when somebody went and said, give me a deed for the land. And when they formed the Land Titles Act, the Northwest Territories Act, said everything has to be in accordance with the Torrens land system and register that land title. These are just old historic documents, really old. They're all, I'm going to say, 100 and some years old, at least.
This is not Alberta land, mostly.
No, it's Manitoba. Yeah, it's Manitoba land. Yes.
Have you done any sort of research at all in terms of the history of land entitlement in Ontario, like for oil and gas in Ontario?
No. They have some, Canada has some files for Ontario, but they, for the most part, have somebody in Ontario managing it. So they have done no work that I'm aware of. They've looked at the little bit of land they've had, but not the historical part that we're talking about from the 150-year celebration.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering about, you know, what was the land ownership like 150 years ago?
I think, if I mentioned the Montreal vault, I think sometimes we have trouble. We have to go back to CP, back to Montreal. And I think those are 150, these are 125 years old. I think 150 might be in the CPR archives. Because these ones started in 1881, but I'm sure their CP kept a lot of files, and they've archived most of their stuff. Anyway, I just talked to the person that took over from Bonnie Mack, and they often did tours of the Encana archives, and she said if the group would like a tour of their archives, we could certainly set one up.
Gordon, perhaps you could shed some light on one question that relates to CPR ownership of minerals and land. My understanding, and I believe that's my understanding, is that the original grant provided them rights to minerals and surface.
That's true.
On a condition that if the railroad was ever abandoned, they would lose their rights to the land and minerals that had been granted them on either side of the railroad line. Is that something you care to comment about, or is there any foundation to that, or what is the status of
it? I've heard that question before. The question was, when the original grant was, CPR was granted the rights as long as the railway was not abandoned. And I think somebody said as long as it was used for railway purposes. And the question is, would you like to comment on it? I said, I know nothing about it other than that's a question that comes up all the time. And I think even if you asked in Canada, they wouldn't comment on it. So I'm sure it's a question that comes up all the time, and I've only heard the question, I've never heard an answer to that. Because it's a, to me it sounds like it goes back to a question even around COVID methane today, and we're talking about split rights and right ownership, and those questions come up, then they go to court and they get challenged, and we find what the courts decide. Because it's around that, who owns the COVID methane? Is it the coal owner, or is it the gas owner? And so
has
those
that
questions,
been resolved?
No. Well, it sort of has, but no, not really. At the end of the day, I think everybody decided the only way you're going to get a true answer is it has to go to court, much like the Boris case did.
So what you want to do if you're going for coal-bed methane is to buy the coal rights, too?
Buy the coal rights to release them.
And then you've got to vote.
Right. I think that's what most of the industry does now. They get all the rights before they drill. What was solved recently was, can you proceed without them? And at one time, you couldn't do anything unless you owned it all or had the consent of the coal owner. And I think business was kind of held up a little bit by the EUB, but they said, no, we're, business can carry on, but we still really haven't determined who owns the legal right to that.
So you haven't determined how you're going to carry on doing the business, doing the world.
You're going to go out, like most of the companies go out and acquire it. So they get the coal rights, they get the gas rights, they get all the rights. So once you own them all, there's no question that you own it. The right, own it, or you have the right to lease it.
Okay. Yes. What was the date of the Supreme Court of Canada? Prior to that, it was a court. What was the date at this time that the Privy Council decided that the petroleum was in the
So, that's right. So really what happened to that, the Boris case, it started before TURTA. So the Supreme Court of Canada didn't have the final say. The final say was the Privy Council in England. So the Boris case went to the Privy Council in England. TURTA started actually after it. But the Supreme Court of Canada ruled on that case because the Supreme Court then had the authority to do that. But the Boris case decision came later, even though because it started with the Privy Council on England. That's kind of the way it was. And that was the highest court in the land was the Privy Council on England. And it was the last case the Privy Council heard. It was a matter of timing, the legal precedent.
What was that date?
That was in 1949. I can't... this thing's got security and I can't go back to it, but it was around, it was in 1949, they were both in 49, but one, it's the timing of the dates. But those are the kind of files that really, I think, should be somewhere, because they are public documents, and I think they're captured somewhere, but I know in Canada has lots of files, but should they be at the Glenbow or somewhere else?
Probably the Privy Council records.
Yeah.
The Canada Gazette.
I think they were in the Canada Gazette.
You can go down to the law library and the law court.
But I know the originals are at the Canada Archives.
Sounds like a candidate for the Digital History Project,
right,
which is digitizing a lot of historical records.
Some of them are right now.
So one last slide. I just put this up because I actually thought it was pretty good. It says, I think I speak for all of us when I say it's very clear what Gord is talking about. I don't have a clue what he was talking about, but that's always my goal, is to make sure you knew what I was talking about. So hopefully I've met that goal today of sharing some knowledge with you, and hopefully you came away with something. I know I picked up some good comments from people, and it's an ongoing process to capture that history accurately. And hopefully one day in Canada we'll document the book. The idea is to get a book out and get all the stories that go with it, not just the slides. Okay, thank you.
Good. Thank you. like to present you, Gordon, with a set of our historical pins.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming out today. Have a safe and enjoyable holiday season, and we'll see you all in the new year.
I'm trained. I did all